When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds.
And Justice Thomas has hired a law clerk accused of sending racist texts. We have such an interesting show for you today. Former U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid stops by to talk to us about her new book, Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Then we'll talk to Carlos Lozada about his new book, The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians. But first, we have the host of The Enemies List, the Lincoln Project's own Rick Wilson. Welcome back, Rick Wilson.
Molly Jongfast.
Whatever this show is called, nobody knows.
Whatever it's called, whatever it is, whatever we do, we're back again for you, America.
Exactly. You and I here to dissect the week of fuckery. And what a week it was. There was a lot of stuff that got written about and talked about. And certainly the Smirnoff, right, the Russian asset, who turns out the lead witness in the impeachment against Joe Biden.
The centerpiece of their entire horseshit, bullshit, weapons-grade, garbage, pretend impeachment case against Joe Biden turns out to have not only been a criminal, but a Russian asset who was meeting with senior Russian intelligence officials. Did you read that charging document on the guy?
No, but tell us what's in it.
Folks, you've heard Jim Comer, Slow Jim, and Jim Jordan over and over again talk about this gold-plated Class A witness who is a direct witness to seeing Joe Biden take sacks of cash from the Burisma executives and having his corrupt son Hunter direct this gigantic international criminal scheme. And it turns out, I know you're going to all be shocked to hear this, it turns out the entire thing, every last detail of it, was completely made up. None of it was real. It was hot garbage from the very beginning. And now they're desperately trying to retcon this thing and like put it in reverse. Like, well, we didn't really know who this guy was. He was an intern, a coffee boy. We barely knew him.
My favorite was Jim Jordan saying that it doesn't change any of the fundamentals, right?
Which is, we're going to impeach Joe Biden because we're a bunch of assholes with nothing better
vibes
to do.
Vibes-based.
Right. For vibes. It's all vibes.
But we don't like this guy. We don't know why. But we know that's high vibes and misdemeanors.
That's good.
That, my friends, is the episode title. High vibes and misdemeanors.
That's right. Misdemeanors.
No, look, and you and I were talking about this earlier in the week. They're not going to stop doing this. They will continue this BS until the sun dies into a burnt cinder because they have nothing else to offer. They have no other plan.
Their boss told them to, right? I mean, they're all arms of the Trump campaign at this point.
Right. And look, the fact that in 2016, the Russians had to kind of sort of maybe disguise their role in helping Trump was one thing.
Right.
Now, it's like, well, why, yes, I do enjoy taking Russian intelligence materials, because after all, who's our real ally in the world but Vladimir Putin?
Well, that is thanks to Tucker Carlson. And also, you know, the far right industrial media complex has decided that authoritarianism is the way to go and that democracies are for cucks and losers. And I think that's right. But, you know, it's interesting because it's like this House impeachment inquiry, it comes from this Republican House. Republicans control only the House right now. And yep. They control it by 2 seats at this point.
And fewer every day.
Right. And then they have a few like non-voting seats. So the math is they actually have more than 2 seats. But what I think is really interesting about this is like next week, they're probably going to shut down the federal government because the Speaker of the House had this like brilliant idea. Again, Mike Johnson, all he wants is to not be removed from this job, right? That's all he just wants to keep his job.
I think there are other things he wants too, but we're not going to discuss those on a family show.
Right. Yes. Oh, Jesus. But anyway.
Molly's like, oh God, he's going to work blue.
Right. I know.
He's going dark.
This is the problem is that like for Rick to talk about Mike Johnson and not talk about the porn accountability, it's like he just can't do it.
Listen, and who can blame me?
I can blame you. But anyway.
Well, you can.
I certainly can. I can. I will. So Mike Johnson has this one. There's still in place this one person motion to vacate. So it's probably not going to be Matt Gaetz this time, but it could be any other member of Congress.
A Chip Roy, a Marjorie Taylor Greene, could be anybody.
Marjorie Taylor Greene has already said she will do it if he funds the government. So he's sort of thrown out a bunch of things I read in Punch Bowl this week that maybe they would shut down the government a little bit. I mean, he cooked up this idea of a tiered CR. I want to just talk about it for a second. A CR is you fund the government temporarily. You did it as a tiered so that half would expire at one point and then half would expire 3 weeks later. No one's ever done this because it's a stupid waste of time. But I think in his like lizard brain, he was thinking like, maybe I'll trick them into not thinking I'm funding the government. I mean, I think it's worth just pulling back here for a minute and realizing that this crew is really quite stupid.
Well, I mean, look, let's be very, very direct about who we're talking about here. These are people who have a very deliberate hatred for any kind of experience or knowledge or expertise. And the purpose of their position in Washington is not about serving their constituents or helping the country or passing legislation. Their entire purpose is chaos. That is the only reason they are there, is to cause and stoke more chaos. And the only incentive they have is chaos. What do you get on Fox for? Do you get on Fox for saying, well, yes, I was in the subcommittee today and we worked on electric vehicle mandate standards or whatever? No, you get coverage on Fox by saying, today I fought back against the pedo cuck army of Soros shills and I burned it all down. And of course, burning it all down is all they care about. So you got Mike Johnson clinging to power and political life by a thread. And look, no one in that organization, no one in the House cares whether they keep the government open or closed. They want it to be chaotic. They want the problems of a shutdown. They want the chaos of a shutdown. And they all do it because they want to please Donald Trump and they want to get on Fox News. These are the only things that matter. And so that's what we'll get more of.
So I want to talk to you about something that you as a campaign guy are going to be obsessed with because it's so stupid. I want to talk to you about Republicans and in vitro fertilization in the great state of Alabama. third hospital in Alabama said they're not going to do IVF. The court ruling from the Alabama Supreme Court, they are taking this country back to the 18th century. They have decided that embryos are people. Discuss.
I will say this. The most consequential and far-reaching political moment of the last 5 years was the Dobbs decision, in which the Republican Party, which they'd been telling Democrats for 50 years, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it, and they did it. They woke up the next morning and said, wait, what? A quarter of our female voter population in the Republican Party is either actually like Roe v. Wade pro-choice or libertarian stay the hell out of my business pro-choice? What? What's happening here? They were shocked that this suddenly bit them on the ass politically in 2022. And that bit them hard, and it's still hurting them right now. If you think that Dobbs blew a hole in the Republican Party's coalition, particularly with women who were more educated and affluent, IVF, if Dobbs was a bomb, IVF is a nuclear war. You are going to see Republican women, Democratic women, independent women lose their damn minds over this for absolutely good reasons. Because you know what? If an embryo is a baby, if they're going to play this game, you know, Nikki Haley had a child by IVF, and Mike Pence and his wife and mother had a child by IVF. And I know people, and you know people, who've had children by IVF, and it was a great blessing for them.
Ben and Darwin, my twins, were made in a lab in New Jersey. And I want to point out that, like, in New York, people are having IVF. They're having surrogacy. They're having, you know, there's no stigma about this. It's ridiculous. I mean, you know, if you can't have children, we have science. That's what science is for. People don't die of the measles anymore. That's what science is for. I mean, this is like, you know, as much as this is about the end of Roe v. Wade, it's also about a Republican Party that hates science. I mean, you watch these Trump rallies and they're advertising ivermectin next to Trump. I mean, this is not just the end of women's reproductive freedom. This is the end of like legitimate science-based freedom. And the thing that I'm so struck by is when you talk about the architect of overturning Roe v. Wade, the guy who created SB 8 in Texas, which functionally overturned Roe a year before, a guy called Jonathan Mitchell has told the New York Times last week, he said, we're not going to talk about this. We don't need a federal ban because we have the Comstock Act, an act from the 1800s that prevents you from sending pornography in the mail. He's going to use that on abortion pills. And like, even now the abortion pill case is about trying to overturn FDA approval. So this is not just about abortion pills. This is about a broad rejection of science more generally.
Well, look, you've got Christopher Rufo, who is a famous right-wing troll, but who also now is, you know, DeSantis put on the board of New College in Florida, and he's a big influencer in the right-wing space. Last night, he's out basically saying, well, you know, once birth control is done away with for women, then we'll get back to the purpose of sex, which is procreation and creating families. This entire movement, they are so running into a gigantic cultural and social buzzsaw that they have not calculated yet how deeply they're going to break their coalition. You know what? If y'all want to go off and go to Alabamistan and have 12 kids, more power to you. God bless. Do your best.
I want to pause for a second and talk about this. Alabama is one of the 15 states that has rejected millions in federal dollars to promote food assistance, right? They've rejected food assistance. They've rejected Medicaid expansion.
Food is for cucks, Molly. It's weak.
This is a state where you're forced to have your baby. You can't have a baby you want, and you also are not going to feed poor children. Like, it's exactly the opposite of everything Christianity teaches.
Sure. You've got a state that is determined to inject not just Christianity into its politics, but a specific narrow-casted edge of evangelical Christianity into its politics. And when you read that decision, it is, these embryos are made in the image of the Lord, etc. Okay, you are free to believe that. That is not law or jurisprudence, that is your faith. And if you believe that, more power to you. Great, go forth and conquer. But the brutal reality is we now have people who are overt theocrats seeking to impose a specifically narrow type of evangelical Christianity on every single American. And we've both talked to Tim Alberta about his book, about how politicized the MAGA religious movement has become and how far it is from faith and how much it is about a social and cultural rejection of modernity. And whether that's science or whether that's birth control or whether that's medicine, they don't want to live in this century. They don't want to live in the last century. They want to live in the 19th century or before. And it's all because they believe at the fundamental underpinning of all this, when you get right down to it, is they're worried that the brown people are having more babies than they are. That's what's really underneath all of this.
Right, is racism.
The white replacement theory informs so much of what's happening here.
Biden HQ has been very smart about clipping things, and they clip this Dasha Burns talking to Senator Tuberville, and she says, do you have a reaction? This is the Alabama senator, right? Do you have a reaction to the Alabama Supreme Court ruling? Senator Tuberville, I'm all for it. We need to have more kids. Dasha, but IVF is used to have more children. And IVF services are paused at some clinics. So there is a slim but real chance here that Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest member of the United States Senate, and this is, by the way, the competition is stiff. Do we think he may not know what IVF is?
He doesn't know what IVF is and does. He thinks them scientists in their coats are making the babies die. That's what he thinks. And look, there's a moral question underneath this idea that, okay, we're going to ban IVF. In order to promote what? What does banning IVF actually do? The idea of fetal personhood is very central to all this. But once again, none of them are going to propose that we go out and provide any kind of family support, family leave, healthcare for any of these tens of millions of children who are yet unborn. I know people, you know people, who have struggled to have children, who desperately want to have kids. And now what they're saying is, we're so afraid that there's some overlay with our anti-abortion crusade with IVF that we're going to ban IVF. It's a fascinating and really dark place. Sorry.
I really want you to weigh in on what this is like electorally for them. You're a campaign guy.
Bad and also terrible. Stupid and also idiotic. Moronic and yet blistering with stupidity and political consequences they have yet to reckon.
Can you just talk about the birth control, like that they're making overtures towards birth control? Do voters like that?
If you want to try to find like a 95% issue in American politics, you're going to struggle, okay? Getting a 95% issue is really, really tough in American politics. And I haven't polled it yet this week, but I'm going to guess, I'm just going to make a quick back of the envelope calculation that banning birth control is about a 0.01% favorable. You get right down to it, and the lack of understanding of political consequences in order to keep a narrow slice of the social conservatives happy, it may end up being the thing that legitimately kills the Republican Party in this country.
As Lindsey Graham says, they will have deserved it, right?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's funny because it's like I grew up in the time when Tipper Gore was coming for pornography and people gave up on that because Americans love pornography. Here, as the daughter of an erotic writer.
Yeah.
Love pornography. They love it.
You may have noticed that Americans love pornography. They like sex. The idea, you got Christopher Rufo, one of the biggest leaders in the social conservative movement, out saying, we're going to get rid of birth control because the purpose of sex is procreation. Good luck. Good luck in America. Good luck anywhere in the world with that.
I have somebody tell that to Matt Schlapp.
Matt's encounters are rarely going to result in children.
Oh.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Did you know Rick Wilson and I are bringing together some friends for a general election kickoff party at City Winery in New York on March 6th? We're going to be chatting right after Super Tuesday about what's going on, and it is going to probably be the one fun night for the next 80 days. If you're in the New York area, please come by and join us. You can go to City Winery's website and grab a ticket. Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney and author of Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Welcome to Fast Politics, Barbara McQuaid.
Hi, Molly. Great to be with you.
I'm so happy to have you. And first, I want to talk about the book. So the book is called Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Can you talk to us about why disinformation and sort of why that was where you went with this?
Yeah. So, you know, my background is as a national security prosecutor. That's what I did for most of my career. And I watched the threat evolve from Al-Qaeda, to ISIS, to cyber, to Russia, and finally to disinformation. And now I teach a law school class on the tensions between national security and civil liberties. And so in 2016, I started assigning our students to read Robert Mueller's report about Russian disinformation. It's a bit of a distraction when people talk about it as, you know, what did he conclude with regard to Donald Trump? There's a fascinating discussion in there about Russian disinformation, about the use of social media to sow division, to influence voters, and a really sophisticated propaganda campaign. And since 2016, I have seen those same tactics now being used by political operatives in the United States. And if you listen to the way Donald Trump speaks and talking about, you know, January 6th insurrectionists as hostages, or saying we need to preserve presidential immunity as if that is a thing. He is using some of those same tactics that we saw in 2016 by Russia. And frankly, once I started digging into it and studying, the same tactics we saw by Hitler and Mussolini and other authoritarians throughout history. And so my goal in writing the book is really to just share with the public in a readable and accessible way the things that I've learned in my research, the danger of disinformation, and how it is being used against us to manipulate.
It's really interesting that you're talking about this because I've had people on this podcast like Jason Stanley. Jason Stanley is a professor at Yale who focuses on this sort of post-Reconstruction anti-democracy movement in the Republican Party. And I'm sort of mis-explaining what he does. But we talked about how unusual it is. Donald Trump is so gifted at misinformation and disinformation that right now he's on the stump talking about how his opponent is a danger to democracy.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, one of his most recent posts on the ironically named Truth Social talked about how the death of Navalny in Russia makes him fearful of what's happening in our country by his opponents. I mean, talk about a jujitsu move. Yeah, Jason Stanley is actually quoted in my book because he does talk about the use of propaganda really before, during, and since World War II, about the way Hitler and Mussolini used propaganda to manipulate a population. And we see those same tactics used today. Now, the methods of delivery are a little different with social media and cable news, but the tactics are really the same. So I talk about the history of disinformation. I talk about the cognitive forces that cause it to work. And then I talk about some of the tactics. And I'll mention just a couple of them because they really are some of the things we are seeing Donald Trump and others use today. You know, he's not the only one referring to insurrectionists as hostages. We see Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from New York, repeating that phrase, or Marjorie Taylor Greene in Georgia repeating that phrase. And so one of the things that I learned that Adolf Hitler knew and wrote about in Mein Kampf, and that Joseph Goebbels, his propagandist, talked about, is that you must use simple messages, understandable to the masses, and then repeat them over and over again so that people hear them from so many different sources. They begin to think, well, it must be true because I hear it all the time from so many different people. I see it from my friends. I see it on television. I see it on social media. That's one. Just repeat the simple message. So a stolen election in 2020, stop the steal. Everybody hears it and they begin to believe it. The other fundamental aspect of disinformation is that a big lie is ironically more believable than a little lie. Hitler talked about this in Mein Kampf. That's because all of us have experienced little lies. Most of us tell little lies because it's a kind thing to do. My husband might say to me, no, that dress doesn't make you look fat, dear. He's being kind. All of us, you know, your hair looks just fine, I might say to my daughter. We're all accustomed to that. But what Hitler said is no one would have the audacity to tell a big lie. And because we think that, we think it would be so immoral to tell a big lie that most of us just can't even imagine telling a big lie. You know, of course, for him, it was that, you know, Jews were the source of all problems in our world and we need a solution to them. But what we're hearing today, of course, is this idea of a stolen election. And I think people think, I mean, it must be true because it would be so easy to disprove if it weren't stolen. But in fact, it's not, because it's 50 individual state elections. And so if you throw that out there and say it enough, you could undermine people's confidence in the election. And that's a big part of it. You know, I've just heard in recent days, Donald Trump telling people that voting by mail is unreliable because he's already laying the groundwork so that when we see people in his own party choose to vote in person and people in the other party choose to vote by mail, and we see this red mirage, just as we saw in 2020, where in the early returns, he's winning. And then later, in as the mail-in ballots are counted, he loses. He can say, they flipped the votes. It was fraud, don't you see? And so this idea of simple, repeatable lies about a big, audacious fact is right out of the, what, you know, sometimes referred to as the authoritarian playbook.
Now, I wonder if you could just explain a little bit about, so this is like an obsession of mine right now. I have this theory that part of how we are here is that Congress refused to regulate social media at all. And had they been just a little bit more careful ahead. So, for example, in 2005 or 2006, when all this started, if they had said, you know, if you're going to link to a story, you have to pay, you know, like made it so that these social media sites had to have editors or fact checkers so that there was some sense in which, you know, if you just put up something that said like the election was stolen, that there would be some kind of pushback from the platform. That doesn't happen, right? So I'm wondering, like, obviously this is tangential, but I'm wondering if you think regulation could have prevented some of this.
Absolutely. And I also think it's not too late. I think we must regulate social media. In this polarized world, there is this concept called the either-or fallacy. And people want you to think that there are only two sides of every issue. You're either with us or against us. You're either a Republican or a Democrat. You're red or blue. You favor free speech or you want to be a censor is what it comes down to when we start talking about social media. You know, Elon Musk, any regulation is censorship. And of course, that is not the case. There is far less restriction on social media than there is on television and radio, where there are regulations that require disclosure of who paid for ads, for example. On social media, there is no requirement to disclose who pays for ads. So Russians could be paying for ads, or large corporations could be paying for ads, or one really rich guy could be paying for ads. And instead, they use a name like the Red, White, and Blue Grandmothers of America, and no requirement to disclose. You know, when you watch an ad on television or hear one on the radio, they'll say, I'm candidate so-and-so and I approve of this ad, because they have to disclose. That's not true on social media. So I think there's a lot we can do to regulate social media that would comply with the First Amendment and fall short of censorship. So one of the things we've learned about social media from the congressional testimony of that whistleblower named Francis Haugens was that it wasn't so much about the content, but about the algorithms that is so manipulative. So Facebook, for one, was using algorithms that was designed to push content that would outrage us. The more outrageous the content, the more it would get, they introduced the dislike and hate emoji. And the more that was attached to an article, the more likely that would show up in a prominent place in our feeds. And the reason was that kept you on the platform, it kept you looking at advertisements, and it made them money. Instead, we could require them to disclose their algorithms. Maybe we don't prohibit them, or we could tell them you can't use certain algorithms that manipulate your users in this way. So there are a lot of things we can do, from requiring disclosure of the payment of ads to requiring some transparency around algorithms that would be very helpful, I think, that could avoid arguments about content. Now, I'd go even further than that and say that when there is controversial content, they should push us toward other sources that, you know, even if they're not saying this is false, if it's about an election, maybe it gives us the website to our state secretary of state so we could read more about elections. I think we could do those things. Can we require it under the First Amendment? I don't know, but I think we can permit it. You know, currently before the Supreme Court, there are a couple of lawsuits pending, one out of Texas, the other out of Florida, where they have statutes that have been passed that would prohibit content moderation as censorship, as violating First Amendment rights. So that those are a pair of cases I am looking for. And media companies have joined against those statutes to say without content moderation, social media would be a toxic hellscape. You think it's bad now? Just wait till we stop moderating all the threats and harassment and other things we see there. You know, there is an argument on the right that social media platforms have a pro-left bias and they are censoring things on the right. I think what the social media platforms would say is, well, we do take down things that threaten people, that harass people, that target groups. And so this Supreme Court decision will decide whether that is permissible. I shudder to think what social media will look like if those social media companies lose.
I always think of this Supreme Court as doing the worst possible thing. But do you have some feeling that they might not?
I have some feeling that they might not. I don't know that they always do the worst possible thing. I think that this Supreme Court is extremely conservative. I think they are exercising their power, even if it requires an overreach of the normal rules about when to overturn precedent. But I don't think they're MAGAs, and I don't think they're in the bag for Trump. I think that that means that in some decisions, we will see not the worst possible thing they can do, but, you know, they also favor big business. And so the media giants are also big business. And so I think they will look somewhat favorably there as well.
So crazy. So we know so much more. Like in 2016, what happened? We saw disinformation weaponized against Hillary Clinton. Like I think about Hillary's emails. It's funny. I was listening to On the Media today, and someone who was like a straight down the middle journalist was saying, no, Hillary's emails was a great story and really important. And I think that we did the right thing by just endlessly rehashing them. But they really were set out in a way that was disinformation. Can you talk a little bit about WikiLeaks?
Yes. So this was an influence campaign, which is slightly different from a disinformation campaign, but it is still intended to influence the outcome of an election. So you may recall the timing of all of this. Russia steals emails from the Democratic National Committee. And, you know, that includes Hillary's emails, that include the party chair, and they hold on to them for a little while. And then the day the Access Hollywood tape gets released, in which Donald Trump is saying some disgusting things that is very likely to lose him a lot of voters, particularly women, now is when WikiLeaks decides is the time to drop these emails. And so they drop a lot of emails, including some that were accurate, that were unflattering to people in Democratic Party leadership. And so Russia is controlling the narrative. Instead of talking about Access Hollywood, that gets pushed off the front page. And instead, we're talking about palace intrigue in the Democratic Party. So that gets repeated. Of course, the other email scandal is a different one, which was Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. Certainly careless, certainly is something that voters should have been thinking about and been aware of. But this idea that it was ever criminal was, you know, far-fetched from the start, ultimately concluded, the FBI concluded no crime. And then Jim Comey, I think, makes a real serious mistake.
I do truly, truly hate Jim Comey. I'm sure you've worked with him. And
I think he's a decent person, but I think that he overestimated his own personal credibility when he thought that he needed to say some things. I don't know if it was to appease Republicans or because he thought he himself had such great credibility that people would accept what he had to say. I think when times are tough, it's best to follow DOJ policy.
And not just go out on your own and throw the election to Donald Trump.
Yeah. And both in July, when he said the investigation was closed, you know, he made a lot of disparaging comments about Hillary Clinton that is in violation of DOJ policy. Just as we have seen, by the way, with Robert Hur and Joe Biden talking about, you know, his memory and he's elderly and other things. There is a DOJ principle of federal prosecution that says the prosecutor should refrain from disparaging a person when charges will not be filed. And so back to 2016, I digress. And then when he reopens the case, you know, they discover a few more emails on, I think it was Anthony Weiner's computer, and they realize that he looked at some more, and he didn't know how long it would take. In fact, it took a few days and they were done before the election. But he felt the need to report to Congress that they had reopened the investigation. I don't understand why there was a need to do that. Ordinarily, it is the policy of the Department of Justice to neither confirm nor deny the existence of an investigation. I think at that point, if charges are merited, you file them. But to say we're going to be looking at these emails over the next few days, it just put the matter in the headlines again. It stayed there for several days.
And it lost her the election.
I don't know if we know with mathematical certainty, but in light of how close that election was, it certainly had to sway voters to see those headlines. And the other data point I'll mention, Molly, is that there is, I forget the statistic now, but more than any single policy issue, Hillary Clinton's emails dominated the news cycle by a factor of, you know, I forget the number, but it's, you know, 60 to 1 or some outrageous ratio. And so that became the narrative on Hillary Clinton instead of anything about, you know, her experience or positions between the two parties, between the two candidates. And so I do think that that issue, both the way the Justice Department and Jim Comey in particular handled Hillary Clinton's email investigation and the way Russia used WikiLeaks to drop these emails on the public in October, close to the election, to push the Access Hollywood tape off of the headlines, I think those absolutely had some influence in the outcome of the election.
Jesus, such a nightmare. So if you were committed to trying desperately to stop foreign interference in our elections right now, what would you do? Give me one or two suggestions.
Well, for foreign influence, I would say most importantly is to get transparency in advertising on social media. I don't know if we're going to see that change happen in time for the election. I would also eliminate anonymous users on social media. We know from Robert Mueller's report that there were account holders that had millions of followers that were Russian operatives. There was one called Blacktivist that spent many months gaining followers, saying things that seemed very mainstream. If you were, you know, who this person purported to be, a Black activist, lots of things that people would like and share and follow. And they believe this person to be a credible Black activist. And then as the election approached, said things like, don't vote for Hillary, stay home. You don't have to vote for Trump. Just don't vote for anybody. Vote for Jill Stein. Hillary doesn't care about the Black vote. Don't vote for her. And so that was made possible by anonymous accounts, by the ability for people to call themselves Blacktivist. And so I think we should require social media companies to verify all of its users, and not by simply paying a fee, but by genuinely sharing identification documents so that people are who they say that they are, because I think that is a really dangerous way that disinformers can succeed. Now, I'm more worried about attacks from within our own country than I am about foreign interference. I'm worried about political operatives now who have learned from the Russians how this game is played. And so Trump has Truth Social, where he is posting all kinds of things that are trying to persuade voters that things that are not true are true. You know, he's been talking about, we need to preserve our great presidential immunity, as if that's
right.
a real thing.
Yeah.
But people will see that and think, oh, it's Jack Smith who's trying to change the status quo and weaken our presidency, when that's not the case at all. There's no such thing.
Thank you so much, Barb, for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
Well, thanks, Molly. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I'd love to anytime.
Carlos Lozada is an opinion writer at The New York Times and author of the Washington book, How to Read Politics and Politicians.
Welcome to Fast Politics, Carlos Lozada.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller. Let's talk about this book. You know, I was reading the excerpt in The New York Times yesterday, and I'm hoping you could explain to us your theory of the case with this book.
Sure. So I've been a Washington journalist for about 25 years. I'm like dating myself here. And in that time, I've read a ton of Washington books. You know, I define that very broadly. It's like, you know, presidential memoirs and biography and, you know, journalist books on campaigns and the like, but also commission reports and Supreme Court opinions, special counsel investigations, you know, all the texts of official Washington. And I've covered these as a book critic for the Washington Post and now as an opinion columnist at the New York Times. And when people hear that this is how I spend my time, like, you know, like reading like Mike Pence's memoir and, you know, that sort of thing, people say to me like, wow, I'm glad you're reading those books and telling us what's in them. But like, I would never read them. Like, you're reading them so that we don't have to. And the implication of like, you read them so we don't have to, is that these books are bad, right? They're self-serving, boring, or they're propaganda. But I am a real believer in the Washington book. I want to make the case for the Washington book, because what I've found, you know, for all these years of reading and writing about them, is that no matter how carefully these political figures, you know, sanitize their records and their experiences or present themselves in the most, you know, favorable, electable, confirmable light, they always end up revealing themselves, right? In some way, you know, they end up telling us who they really are. And it could be like a little throwaway line here, a recurring phrase, something in the acknowledgments. The acknowledgments are, by the way, like an amazing source of information about these people. But it's in there somewhere, right? And that means that even books that are, I grant you, all of those things, right, propagandistic and self-serving, are still really illuminating about our politicians, but also about our politics. And so my book, The Washington Book, is a collection of my digging into, my deep dives into Washington books over the past decade, basically starting from like This Town, you know, by Mark Leibovich, through to, you know, the Trump indictments. That's the Washington book. And I hope that once you get through it, you will find that the case for the Washington book is real and that these really are, you know, if you read carefully enough, very revelatory texts.
Yeah, this is a really good point, especially when you talk about things like the Trump indictment or the Mueller report or these large reams of paper filled with information that may or may not be carefully combed through. Can you talk about other books like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's just a slew of different examples. Before we get into like the big reports, I want to like one example of a book that maybe not a lot of people read, but that to me was incredibly useful to understanding Barack Obama, for instance. You know, he wrote Dreams from My Father and Audacity of Hope and now his first presidential memoir, you know, and those are fine. Those are good books to read to try to understand him. I read those, but I also read this book by Reggie Love, who was the guy who was his personal aide, like, you know, the body man that, you know, candidates and presidents have. He wrote a book called Power Forward, My Presidential Education. He was a basketball player, so that's how Power Forward, you know, makes sense. But there was one little detail in that book that for me just captures Obama so well. It's the only thing I remember from this book, or the thing I remember best from this book, I should say. And that is that there was a moment when Reggie Love forgot to bring Obama's briefcase on the plane. And, you know, he's like, oh, my God, I'm going to get fired. You know, he's freaking out. Obama, you know, was annoyed, but gracious and, you know, forgave him for it. And then Love explains, you know, that Obama mentioned one reason he had been so annoyed about the missing bag. And he said he wanted to be seen carrying something off the plane because he said JFK carried his own bags. And like that told me so much. That told me how carefully Obama thought about his public image and how he was sort of hearkening back to perhaps our most mythologized former president to develop the image and story behind perhaps our second most mythologized former who was Barack Obama. And so that's just one little detail in a book that did not make major waves. But if you read them, you find stuff like that. That's why I, you know, sort of enjoy digging through these books.
Really interesting. So, but talk to us about these huge government reports, because there's so much in there. And they're also, I mean, certainly there are people who dig through them, but being someone who has all this knowledge from reading all these books and then is going into these reports, explain to me a little bit. I mean, do you ever find stuff in there that is like, holy shit, no one's seen this?
There's two ways to kind of comb through these books, right? One is looking for that little detail that is, you know, sort of new and revelatory or sometimes ambiguous in a really fascinating way. So for instance, do you remember Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony in the January 6th hearings, right? And she was there the morning of Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse, right? And she's describing how he wanted them to take the magnetometers away so that even if like his supporters were armed, he still wanted them to come through and be where he was because he wanted the bigger crowd. That was kind of a big dramatic moment.
And they were his people.
They were exactly, you know, let my people in. But there was one moment in Hutchinson's testimony that to me was so interesting because, you know, she quotes him, you know, something along these lines, right? She says that he said, you know, let them through. They're not here to hurt me.
Right.
And depending on how you say that sentence out loud, it has two radically different meanings.
Right.
Think about where you put the emphasis, right? They're not here to hurt me, right? If it's on hurt, then that means what? That means, you know, he thinks they're here to praise me. They're here to support me. They're here to applaud me, right? If it's they're not here to hurt me, then it's suddenly far more nefarious, right? It's they're here to hurt someone else, right? I'm safe, but they might go after somebody else, you know? And so I went back and I looked at the video of her testimony. I looked to see how that quote was rendered in a few different moments in the January 6th committee report. The way she describes it is kind of neutral, you know, in they italicize one word versus the other in different parts of the report. And so it's not exactly clear what Trump actually said in that moment. But to me, that's one of the most fascinating moments in the entire report, right? Like the stress that you put on a single one syllable word can radically change the way you read what happened that day. So to me, that's one of the joys of reading these.
The only thing I would say is that the context seems really important there, right? I mean, like if you didn't know.
Oh, definitely. But, you know, if there's anything that the January 6th report provides, it is that context. The one thing it makes clearest of all, I think, is that Trump knew that all the things he was saying about the election were false, right? Because it, you know, there's this wonderful like 2 or 3 page chart in the middle of the January 6th report where it shows like every time that he had been told by, you know, the attorney general, by a top aide at DOJ, by one of his own campaign staffers, you know, that you know, X, Y, or Z thing was wrong, that actually we lost this stage, or, you know, what you're saying isn't true. And then, you know, it shows how, you know, the exact, you know, day later, he's out, you know, repeating the same lie. But what I find, I try to look at these, all these reports as almost like speaking to each other as chapters of a bigger story rather than as discrete individual moments, right? If you read, say, the Mueller report, and then you read the special committee report on Trump and Ukraine, right? On the perfect call, you know, that thing led to the first impeachment. And then you read the January 6th report, you sort of see how they're talking to each other, right? The Mueller report was very restrained, right? The Mueller report was very cognizant of what it could and could not do. You know, we can indict a sitting president. It sort of bent over backward to give Trump the benefit of the doubt. But it kept saying, actually, this is for some future investigation. This is, I don't want to preempt constitutional remedies. And so it kind of like laid the groundwork for what future investigators could do. And you see how the Ukraine report and the January 6th report, you know, completely picked up on the things that the Mueller report wished it could have done, but wasn't able to do. And so it's impossible for me to read these in isolation from one another. Like that's the key. You know, when the January 6th committee report came out, I used that as an opportunity to write like one big piece about all three of these investigations together, because they really are talking to each other.
That's really interesting. So I want to go back to your case for like Mike Pence's memoir, because I remember seeing that and thinking, like I think about many political books, like, who is this for? Which, again, is not really Mike Pence's problem, right? That's the publisher's problem. But explain to us a little bit about the merits of Mike Pence's memoir. This is a hot take. Perhaps contrarian.
You knew that's why you were having me on, to talk about why Mike Pence's memoir is worth reading.
I read this and I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, there's kind of why these books exist at all, right? I think publishers play a kind of sweepstakes. They think, you know, one of these people is going to be president of the United States. And when that happens, you know, people are going to look a lot at this book, or one of them will become the nominee. And so that's why you end up with like the existence of like a Tim Pawlenty book.
Right. Exactly.
Like Tim Pawlenty's book was, I believe, Courage to Stand, An American Story.
I can't even remember who Tim Pawlenty is. Can you just remind us for my dad, who was listening to this?
Tim Pawlenty was running for president. He was governor of Minnesota.
He was a Republican.
Yes, Republican governor of Minnesota. Brief hot moment when people thought that Teepaw was of presidential timber. He was running for the...
He had palmentum. That's what Jesse just said.
There was palmentum. Yeah, not to be confused with Jomen.
Or clomentum.
Yeah. But he ran for president in 2012, and there was like brief talk that he might be a VP candidate for Romney, but that didn't go anywhere either. I use sort of Tim Pawlenty's book as an example of, you know, a book that someone published, but that bet maybe didn't pan out, in the sense that he, you know, he did not become, you know, either a nominee or a VP, or a book that then someone is going to want to sort of go back to, you know? These are kind of like a publisher's sweepstakes, you know, hoping that one of them pans out. Pence's book, he was already clearly a public figure. This was sort of looking back on his vice presidency. And it came out, you know, after he had distinguished himself by not being hung on January 6th and by not refusing to certify the vote. And this book, it was a bit of a victory lap about, you know, what he had done on January 6th. That was a lot of it. And so in that sense, is it incredibly revelatory on kind of those basic elements? Maybe not. But just like the point I made with, you know, JFK carried his own bags, you know, like there's one moment in the Pence book that I find so telling. And that is when he's looking back on January 6th. And he is talking about how he did the right thing. And then he mentions how Trump finally issued that video telling people to leave the Capitol after taking far too long to sort of make any effort in that regard. He then quotes Pence in his book, quotes from Trump's video address, except he makes one omission in the quote. So here's what he quotes in the book. I know your pain. I know you're hurt, ... but you have to go home now. We have to have peace. So when I read that, I wondered, like, what was the ... Like, what did he skip with the ellipsis, right?
Right.
And so I went to the video, right? And what was gone?
I should not laugh, by the way, because this is American democracy.
Yeah. But here's what was missing. We had an election that was stolen from us. It was a landslide election. Everyone knows it, especially the other side.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
So what's remarkable to me is that even in this book, right, written for posterity, telling your version of the story, on the day when Trump supporters were calling for his hanging, Mike Pence is still covering for the boss. He is still omitting Trump's repetition of the election lie, right? And so to me, that captured everything, right? Like, I think so much of Pence's vice presidency is captured in those three little dots. He would always say, I'm here to serve, right? That's his recurring phrase. I'm here to serve. But who was he there to serve, right? Was he there to serve the people who elected him, or was he there to serve this one man? And so for me, that's why Mike Pence's memoir is illuminating. Even when he's trying to recreate himself, he still can't quite help it. He was still covering for Donald Trump on a day that Donald Trump did not cover for him.
It's such a great and interesting point. He's still covering for Donald Trump, even on a day Donald Trump was not covering for him. It speaks in a larger way to the Republican Party, too, weirdly, right? Like, covering for him as he picks out unelectable candidates, right? Like, constantly, they're in an impossible situation, which they put themselves in. Anyway, explain to us now sort of what you're doing. You have a really interesting mandate. You come from the world of book reviewing. Now you are on the opinion side, but sort of with a book caveat a little bit. And talk to us about what that means.
Yeah, I still try to understand politics through the lens of books. I'm no longer a book critic. You know, the New York Times has, you know, a fantastic book review and outstanding book critics who do a great job and who cover books in that way.
Like Dwight Garner.
Oh, yeah. No. And Jen Salai on nonfiction.
And Alexandra Jacobs. Yes. Continue. Sorry. We should not now call out all the book critics we love. At all. Okay, continue.
But so what I try to do, in a sense, I'm sort of a political writer, I suppose, but who uses political books as my kind of reporting material. That's mainly what I do. So, you know, and it doesn't, you know, it sort of transcends politics as well. Like, one of the pieces that I wrote last year that I'm most, you know, interested in, or kind of happy that I did, was on this question of, you know, whether a U.S.-Chinese conflict is likely, right? And so I read a bunch of different books, five or six books on that subject, just to try to figure that out for myself. And then, you know, wrote about it for The Times. You know, that took a while. I'm really grateful to have editors who kind of let me take the time to do that kind of thing. But, you know, when Liz Cheney's book comes out, when all these kind of prominent political books come out, now I get to pick my spots a little bit more, as opposed to when I was a book critic, I kind of had to review everything that came out. That part is enjoyable. But I, you know, I fully recognize books as a way to understand politics is just my way. But there are obviously so many different lenses. Even if you look at different cultural artifacts, like James Poniewozik, the TV critic at The Times, wrote a really good book about the Trump era through the lens of television, right? Trying to understand Trump as a product of television. And, you know, that's an equally legitimate way to do it. Books just happen to be my way, the way I'm comfortable doing that. I'm starting to look at some of these big kind of government in waiting policy books that are coming out on the Trump side. And that's my way of kind of reporting on what a future administration might look like, what a second Trump term might look like. But again, like through the lens of books.
Carlos, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
Anytime, Molly. Thank you.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Rick Wilson.
Yes.
Do you have a moment of fuckery?
I do have a moment of fuckery, and I'm going to condemn with all the fire and brimstone I can muster at the moment. At CPAC, during one of the opening moments of CPAC this year.
Where you and I are both not.
We are not at CPAC. We had two of the most egregious, low, scumbag, reprehensible people who I would gladly watch submerged in a lake of lava or eaten by wolves Steve Bannon and Jack Posobiec. Jack Posobiec went out and cheerled for the death of democracy and said, we didn't finish the job on January 6th. And Bannon cheered him on, and they talked about how they were going to turn America into a nation where, you know, crisis first before the, anything else. I know that they will try to say, oh, we're just trolling. Watch the libs lose their minds. But what they're doing is trying to shove the Overton window further to the right. What they're doing is trying to give themselves a permission structure and give their people a permission structure to say, yeah, now's the time. We're done with this pesky constitutional republic. We want the autocracy. We want the authoritarianism. And frankly, if Trump is reelected, they're going to get it. This is why I tell people that you cannot let these people pretend that they're joking, pretend that they're trolling, because they're not. They're deadly serious about it. This is what they want. This is what they're working for every single day. And the idea that these assholes, that these scumbags, that these vile, low travelers in this grotesque movement think they're going to get away with this is astounding to me. And the fact that people still in mainstream journalism call Steve Bannon and Jack Posobiec and talk to them and say, hey, what's going on in Trump world, man? How are you, buddy? When their intention and their direction is incredibly clear, they are people that really deserve and need to be thrown as far out of the political process and mainstream in this country as you can imagine. So that's my moment of fuckery.
That is a really good moment of fuckery. My moment of fuckery is, I hate to do this because I feel like they get such a tough time, but, and this is a terrible time in media, but you guys have to stop, okay? Trump and Biden are not the same. The idea, I mean, no. My new thing is that I'll go to a party and someone who's a conservative will say to me, Biden's going to drop out, right? And I'll be like, why would Biden drop out? And I realize that some of it is that there has been so much reporting about Biden's age versus Trump's 91 criminal indictments that these people actually think that Trump is a more suitable candidate. And I'm saying to you, mainstream media people, and, you know, I don't even think it's the journalists. I don't think it's fair to blame the journalists because, you know, the truth is a lot of journalists don't write headlines. I know this myself. Like, you know, you don't get to sign off on the headlines, especially at big places. So I understand. But if you are an editor, right, ask yourself, what am I fucking doing here for American democracy? You don't have to be for the left or for the right, but you do have to be for democratic norms. Having a pro-democracy bias does not make you a partisan. And I think that is really important that these people ask themselves, like, what am I fucking doing? Why am I framing this in a way that both sides are equal? Because they are not. And even the right knows this very well.
They are not equal. They are not equal. Molly, I couldn't agree more with you on this. This is a moment where if Donald Trump wins, they will be the first ones to say, oh my God, I can't believe these new assaults on press freedom. I can't believe that they're passing these new laws to undo Sullivan and to make us liable for every word we say. And I can't believe that they're banning reporters from government events and buildings. I can't believe that they're trying to lock up reporters for reporting things from whistleblowers. They'll be the first ones shocked as hell when people like Bannon and Miller and Patel and the rest of these people are in charge and running American media into the ground. They'll be the first ones to be like, I'm appalled by this. Well, don't say you were not warned.
That's right. Thank you, Rick.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.